Thanks, Mary. So thanks to all the organizers for having me out to speak here. So let's see. Like a couple of our morning speakers, I've put up here the mission that we were given as speakers in this session, and you've been through 5 talks already today, so I thank you for your patience. Unlike, I think, all of the other talks, the approach I've decided to take here is autobiographical, but interspersing sort of thoughts, some raising questions on some of these topics, making suggestions on some of these topics, and just sort of interspersing it, somewhat stream of consciousness almost, as I progress. And I'm not going to stick to my title particularly well, but as I said, my point here is just to raise different thoughts that came to my mind when thinking about these different topics based on my experience in the field. So, to give you context, I thought I should start by mentioning that my PhD is in applied mathematics, and in fact, I think I'm the only of today's speakers who's in a department of mathematics, which I was a little surprised about when I saw the program, since we're at the Fields Institute, but it is a very interdisciplinary field, so it's very appropriate. But so, in writing this down, it suddenly occurred to me, how did I end up in my particular PhD program? Actually, that question, I think, has some relevance for all of us to think about. So I knew that I was interested in working on mathematical biology when I decided to go to grad school, which was straight out of undergraduate studies. And so at that time, we didn't have the internet set up with all these websites, so I requested materials in the mail from all sorts of different universities, and each one had a list of who were the faculty and what their research interests were. And I knew I was looking for, something with differential equations and something with math biology. And so I picked applied math at Brown because there were 3 professors on the list. Well, it seemed like it was a good program, and also there were 3 professors on the list who were working in math biology. And it turned out one of them hadn't done any research in a couple of decades, and one of them was gone. And the third was listed as math biology because he had proved existence and stability results on the Fitzhugh-Nagumo equations. Okay, so my point here is I actually was, I think, a very good undergraduate student, and I had a lot of interaction with faculty at my institution, but I was pretty clueless about how to pick a graduate program, and it worked out fine. But I often find that at Pitt, where I think we have a lot, I know we have a lot of very good mathematical and computational and experimental neuroscience going on, the undergrads who are taking our math classes have no idea about what the research is like at the university, particularly on the math and computational side. So I think it's important to reflect on, how do we attract bright undergraduates to graduate studies in these areas? I mean, we need people. There are so many open questions. We need more people to come in and work on these things. And how do we convey to students what this field is all about? So one possibility is to sort of recruit undergraduates in our classes. We're up there to teach, say, differential equations, but that doesn't mean that we can't, mention how this can lead into certain interesting research directions. And students actually are very receptive to these ideas, I found. We can, make more of an effort to give sort of outreach-type presentations within our universities. Even just putting up posters in the halls, I found, every once in a while, a student who's on my webpage to check what the homework assignment is accidentally clicks on my research button, and that actually, then they're interested. But so I feel personally, and I'm sure this applies to many people, I think it's a good idea if we work harder to get undergrads interested in this area. And branching out, we all make visits to other schools. It's possible to actually talk to undergraduates there. I love these publications, and I'm not even sure who put them out, but there were these annual books, little, monographs, What's Happening in the Mathematical Sciences, sort of highlighting the top 10, research developments in a given year, and these were annual things. It would be great if we had something like that in mathematical neuroscience, but I'm not aware of such a thing existing. And in math, there are these things like the Mathematical Association of America, American Mathematical Society, who are ideal to coordinate these sorts of things. I'm not sure what we have in neuroscience. I mean, the CNS meeting, computational neuroscience, that's certainly one group that could possibly be involved in such a thing, but it's not so clear that there's this sort of dominant umbrella organization to do this. And I'm a big believer in the value of the NSF-funded research experience for undergraduate programs. I'm not sure if Canada has anything analogous, but this is a great way. We do get a lot of really talented undergraduates coming into Pitt in the summer through some programs like this. Okay, so right, so my thesis work, because of the factors that I mentioned, was on a nonlinear optics problem, although it was non-standard in that field in the sense that it was coupled reaction diffusion equations. And I was able to prove the existence of certain standing wave solutions, something like this in time, in space with no time behavior. And then I was able to rigorously establish that certain bifurcations would occur, which could destabilize these solutions. And so one interesting type was this sort of breathing bifurcation where the edges of this thing, the edges of this pulse could either sort of drift one way together and then the other, or they could be antiphase, so they could breathe in and out. And this is, the details are irrelevant. This is dynamics that's taking place inside of a laser cavity, a semiconductor laser cavity. But, in my title, I had to give the title at short notice, and I mentioned from the Evans function to deep brain stimulation and back. So I used the Evans function, something called the Evans function, to perform stability analysis, and then I spent 100 pages of my thesis proving results, or building up the theory, proving results and so on about the Evans function in order to finally be able to say whether these solutions are stable or not. Okay, so I learned a lot of math, although it was fairly focused at this deep of a level. So here's something on the Evans function I'm actually going to skip. Okay, so since then, so this is 10 years, pretty much. These are some of the projects I've worked on, or this is pretty much all of the projects I've worked on. So each one of these bullet points typically represents, say, an average of 2 papers, let's say. So I'm not going to read the list, okay, but maybe you want to glance through it. The point of the list is it's fairly diverse, I would say, in some sense. It's not, to some extent, I guess there's some of what Andre mentioned of trying to use a nutcracker and walking around to different areas, but it's definitely not a case of purely that. I had to learn various techniques along the way to sort of expand into these different areas. I have 2 of them highlighted because I'll come back to them in different parts of the talk. But so there was no way coming out of my PhD program that I could anticipate that I was going to work on all of these areas. In fact, I probably didn't know that any of these areas existed. If you want to be able to sort of move around like this and work on lots of different topics, that leads to this question that the speakers were asked to address of what is the best training for this field. So from my perspective, what is the best training for being able to tackle, these sort of types of problems? And there's no unique answer to this question, as with many questions in the field. One point I wanted to make, that the reason I even put equations up here, is the first thing I worked on was sleep rhythms and some related epilepsies. So this is stuff that Destek and Steriot and others have worked on most prominently. So what these mathematically amounted to were problems about synchronization and forming these clustered activity patterns in synaptically coupled oscillators. So this was a big shift of gears compared to reaction diffusion, because in these ordinary differential equation models, you have these synaptic coupling terms, and the synapses evolve according to their own equations. So they have their own dynamics. And what's more, you have this whole architecture of synaptic connections in the network. So the coupling is suddenly non-local and temporally dependent. So that's a shift that makes this field very rich. That I've really appreciated. But so this was an initial adjustment right off the bat. So anyway, what is the best training for tackling such problems? So my claims are specialized training in neuroscience topics is not a requirement for success in mathematical neuroscience. And training in applied math provides tools that are useful for tackling mathematical neuroscience problems. So the second one, I guess, is less controversial than the first, maybe. I'm not saying that specialized training in neuroscience is bad. I'm just saying if you want to get into the field, you shouldn't feel like you had to have some specialized training in neuroscience topics. Okay, so when I started, in my postdoc, I started working on this stuff. I knew nothing about most of the brain. And so the advice that I was given was just focus on this and learn a lot about the parts of the brain that are involved here, and don't worry about the big, you know, all these other brain areas you're going to hear about, because there's no way you can absorb this all at once. And I think that was really good advice. So if you are coming from a, you're going the route of getting all the quantitative skills in place first, then you can sort of step your way into different problems. The downside of such a specialized training, I have a list of words here, okay, many of which were used in the other talks today. And I could have filled up, you know, this whole slide, well, okay, 40 slides, I don't know, of all the very common, you know, basic terms in computational neuroscience that I had never heard of when I started my postdoc and started working in this area. In fact, I would say probably if I came to this meeting, you know, right after my graduate studies, I would have understood maybe 10-20% of what was said in the earlier talks. And that includes like and, had, the. So I've written papers now, you know, with most of these words in them. I mean, but even the Hodgkin-Huxley equations. I knew about Fitzy-Nagumo. I didn't know anything about Hodgkin-Huxley. I didn't know about integrating fire. So that's a downside. Okay, I went to my first CNS meeting with some results on sleep, you know, synchronization with mutual inhibition, in fact, more specifically. And then I sat down for the talks, and I had exactly this experience. And luckily, it was a good wake-up call that there was a lot more out there than I knew. Another problem is if you have the training only in math, let's say, it's much harder. You know, you have no clue how to generate good problems in neuroscience. Okay, so you need to have good mentoring, good connections with experimentalists to be able to do this. And the comment that I made after Hugh Wilson's talk, I'll repeat again. I think if you are coming from a math background, a nice idea is to sort of look for an existing model that's simple, because there are a lot of those in the field, and try to leverage off of that and see how you can improve that as a way to get into something. It's also maybe very hard to communicate across with people in other disciplines who are working in computational neuroscience. Again, some of these topics, like a filter, I mean, every engineering undergrad probably knows what that is. I didn't know, much less communicating with neuroscientists. So this is very hard to teach anyway, I guess. But that's something to be aware of. If you have a focused training in one area, it's going to be harder to communicate across fields, which is a necessary piece of being in this area. One nice thing about the training in applied math is you automatically think in terms of mechanisms. So one of the problems I've found with the field of computational neuroscience is people like to build these huge models which incorporate lots of nice features from the data, and then they simulate them, and they say, look, this is what this model does. Therefore, you know, this is something we should look for in this part of the brain. And maybe, you know, they're clever, and they can tune some parameters, so they have some sense of something about the system, and they match data in some way. But often, you just see the results thrown at you. This is what the model does. End of story. Okay, and from my math background, In math, you're trying to prove something typically, you know, in rigorous math. So if you want to have a hope of being able to prove that something works a certain way, you have to get some intuition. You have to really understand how the components of these equations are interacting to generate the thing that you're interested in. So that automatically puts you in this frame of mind of thinking about mechanisms. You know, what are the details in the equations that make things work? And so when I have these neuroscience students do rotations with me and build these models, they get stuck a lot on very simple things, even though they're really, really smart, because they haven't thought about what features in the equations are producing this behavior that they don't want to see. So that's a nice thing about making sure you have sufficient math component in your background. Okay, so the challenges then in terms of these thoughts are to develop training that integrates math with neuroscience and to develop training that integrates students with diverse backgrounds. So Ron mentioned his computational neuroscience course and seeing the very strong computational skills in the students. At Pitt, we have two courses, which I think is a good thing. We have a computational neuroscience course and a mathematical neuroscience course, both taught by the math department. And the Comp Neuro gets students from all sorts of different departments, including math. And the Math Neuro does as well, but it's much more math-focused. So that's like the more advanced course where we actually look at some more heavy-duty math involved in neuroscience topics. But so in Comp Neuro, where we're introducing, you know, cable equations, basics of synaptic plasticity, Hodgkin-Huxley equations, things like that, I've got a bunch of math students sitting in there who are, you know, exactly where I was. Okay, they don't know what a synapse is. They don't know what the Hodgkin-Huxley equations are. And then I have a bunch of bioengineering and computational neuroscience or even experimental neuroscience students sitting in there who know more about, cable equations, about, you know, Goldman, Hodgkin, Katz, and so on than I do. And they've never seen a phase plane before. Okay, so that's one of the challenges that I'm implying here. Okay, I don't have a great answer for that one, so I'm interested in your comments on this. One thing that I've heard that has worked well at the undergraduate level is to have what I indicated here as semi-unified courses. So the idea is you have the bio and the math students sitting there in the same room, say twice a week, but then on the third day you actually have separate sessions for the two of them, the two groups. And you go more in depth in the math in the one, would be one way to do it. You know, so for the math students, you pursue some things that the bio students just aren't ready for, and vice versa. Another way to do it is actually to give like a little remedial thing over in the math session. So at the beginning, you know you're going to be getting into the, you know, action potential propagation. So you do a lecture which is like the basics of the cable dynamics just for the math students, you know, to get them up to speed on, you know, equivalent, you know, the circuit, the idea of equivalent circuit even, things like that they haven't seen before. So there are variations on this that might be a good thing. Another thing that I've found wonderful as a faculty member is interdisciplinary journal clubs. So this is maybe at a more advanced level, but you really see what issues, in my case, I really get to see what issues experimentalists look for when they're reading some of these papers that I never would have thought about. And you become much more critical of the work that's out there when you see how an experimentalist looks at these things. And it's helped me a lot to sort of read between the lines and see what's missing in some of these applied papers. Working groups is a nice idea I know has been implemented at Boston University, where you have a group of students who realize that it's very important for them, students and faculty and postdocs say, it's very important for them to learn more about, you know, canards or something, some topic, and then they get together and start from scratch and really work through things together. A controversial one, I think, is the role of experimental rotations in training. So we just developed a new PhD program, which is starting in the fall between Pitt and CMU. That's specifically a program in neural computation. And I think it's going to be a great program. And one of the controversial things, you know, one of the contentious issues when we discussed how to run this program was, should we require students to do experimental rotations? I sort of got the sense from your talk, Ron, that maybe your answer would be yes, but I don't want to put words in your mouth. But my answer is no, okay? I don't think students should be forced to do this. I do think it's important to keep in mind what the perspectives of experimentalists, and to be definitely reading the literature and to be talking to experimentalists, but to actually sit there and do experiments, especially for such a short period as a rotation, I'm not sure of the value of sort of forcing that on students in neural computation. All right, let me think. I've been going a little fast, but I know everyone wants to move on too. So I thought I would sort of jump to one of the research topics I've been working on to illustrate a few more issues that I think should be brought out. This is more to illustrate these issues than to talk about my own research. One very hot topic these days is deep brain stimulation. Okay, so the idea is you take an electrode. Maybe this is a good picture to look at, although it's small here. So this represents an electrode which has been chronically implanted in the brain. So that means surgically implanted and it's left there. Okay? And there's a wire running from this thing down along the neck, this is under the skin, to a pacemaker, which sits here in the collarbone area, okay? And the reason this has become most popular or very popularized these days, I believe, is because of its success in alleviating the motor symptoms of Parkinson's disease. Okay, so it's used for various other conditions as well, but my interest also came from its use for Parkinson's disease. So with this image, these are images from Cameron McIntyre at the Cleveland Clinic, and this one shows various nuclei of the basal ganglia, which is an area drastically impacted in Parkinson's disease. And this is the stimulating electrode. It's got these four leads here, and it's positioned relative to this very small nucleus called the subthalamic nucleus. This is another representation. Okay, so I'm going to quickly mention a few things about these different nuclei in the next couple of slides. But you can see basically the idea is you apply this high frequency current. I'm doing this. Here's so maybe a voltage response of a cell to this current versus time. You apply this high frequency current here, and all of a sudden, in fact, it's really like this. The symptoms disappear. Okay, and it was discovered somewhat as indirectly, serendipitously. And like many other aspects of medicine, the mechanism through which it works is not known. Okay? I wouldn't even say it's very close to being known. Okay? In fact, there's arguments about whether it stops the firing of cells or starts up the firing of cells. Okay? So what we often do, at least what I often do, and many others I know, is take pictures like this, which is already a very simplified representation of brain areas, convert everything into boxes and arrows. So the DBS is being applied to this thing, the STN. DBS stands for deep brain stimulation. And all the colorful things here are different areas of the basal ganglia. And the basal ganglia sends inhibitory outputs finally to the thalamus. So this is the only colorful thing that's not in the basal ganglia. And it's a particular part of the thalamus. VL thalamus. And what our hypothesis is, I mean, it's known that basically all of these different areas of the thalamus receive some cortical inputs and send some inputs back to other cortical areas. So you could sort of imagine this feedback is going on perfectly well, and the basal ganglia's job is to interfere with this. Okay? And it interferes through an inhibitory signal, and it does so in a good way, in normal conditions, when it wants to like block something here so that a movement can be stopped or started. But in Parkinson's, somehow this gets out of control. So the first thing we did was take these two areas with this excitatory inhibitory loop and say, well, people speculate that maybe these guys could be the source of the oscillations that give you the Parkinsonian resting tremor. So we built this big biophysical model for these areas, and this is in the Hodgkin-Huxley type, very similar to Ron's models. So we have our thalamic equations, which are a bunch of ODEs. Each one of these terms is a current, which has some dynamic variables as well as parameters. We've got synaptic connections. We've got similar equations for STN, GPE, GPI. So we have this whole deal, okay? Lots of parameters, lots of terms. And then we wanted to simulate this thing and to analyze it. So we sort of picked a happy medium, what we thought of. We tried some things with 16 cells of each type, as well as 8 cells of each type, because again, we wanted it small enough that we could run it in a reasonable, you know, time, and that we could do some analysis, but big enough that we could play a little bit with the coupling architectures. So this leads me to two important questions for the field. One, I think an important direction that for some reason I don't hear that many people talk about in neuroscience is some sort of automation of fitting parameters for a model like this, okay? And in particular, it would be nice if there were methods that took into account, you know, that it's known that neurons tend to fire action potentials. They don't tend to, produce sine waves. And also, it would be nice to take into account the way that the data is collected, the data that's available. So the other math bio area that I've been working in is inflammation. And in inflammation, this is a huge deal. So we build these models of pro- and anti-inflammatory cytokines interacting, neutrophils, macrophages, bacteria, endotoxin, and so on. And then we have these systems of 10 equations with 50 parameters, and we spend a lot of thought on how to efficiently estimate parameters in a way that fits our data. And in my neuroscience work, I tend to work with small models, and I do a lot of hand tweaking to come up with parameters based on data. It would be nice if there were some more sophisticated techniques that people could use for these models. Maybe it's just that I don't know what people are using. But the other thing is, again, I think it's very important to look at small networks of cells so you can really analyze the mechanisms. And people also work in the continuum limit, because then you get these nice integral differential equations. But something in between, I think, is where we have a gap. So how well do the things that we observe in our little 4-6 cell networks scale up to our 100 cells or 1,000 cells that are still quite short of the continuum? And what are the roles of complex coupling architectures? Okay, this isn't a problem just for neuroscience, but there are a lot of cell systems where people study coupled networks, and it's typically all-to-all or random or nearest neighbor connectivities, but we don't necessarily have that here. So we talk a little bit about this in a poster that a student of mine will be presenting on Monday, Chris Guy-Terry, here at the CNS meeting, but I think this is an important area for more work in the field. So to come back and finish on DBS very quickly, the basic point of view is in Parkinson's, you lose dopamine. Okay, so there's an area of the brain here which atrophies, and this is responsible for dopamine release. So when this is gone, the weights of these connections between a lot of different areas change. Okay, and people developed a very simplified view of what would be happening here just based on this type of reasoning, based on saying, well, we take away an inhibition here, so this area gets more active. So that's this. So now it's inhibiting these guys more strongly, so they become more quiet. So now these guys are freed up from this inhibition, so they become more active, okay, and so on. And so the output here, these guys became more active, and they're exciting these guys, so they inhibit these guys more. And so people would say, well, that's part of the problem in Parkinson's then. These guys are getting too much inhibition all the time, and they can't do what they're supposed to do. Well, that's what I've written here. So the thing is, when you look at the data and some simulations on what's happening in DBS, in fact, it seems that the activity in this, if you apply DBS here, the activity in this area actually gets even more elevated. So if more activity here was bad in the first place, how can even more activity actually suddenly help you again? So that's what we've addressed in a couple of papers. And the key, you know, anyone who's trained in dynamics will realize there's a little flaw in what I've drawn here, right? This area got quiet, so this area got more active, but this area is feeding back. So now this area actually is getting more drive again, so why should it stay quiet? So in fact, there's this feedback loop, so we can actually get oscillations here, and so the key point is going to be this. In Parkinson's, the GPI outputs, that was this loop, this connection here, they don't just become stronger, but they become more rhythmic because you get oscillations upstream here. Okay? And the deep brain stimulation, although it makes these guys even more active, it cuts out this rhythmicity. Okay? So you can see it, right? I mean, tremor is a rhythmic type of thing. DBS is cutting out the rhythmicity and thereby restores the relay. Okay, what the thalamic cells are supposed to do. So stronger inhibition can actually be less of a nuisance if it's more regular. Okay, and so thinking in terms of dynamics, this is a fairly natural statement, but the experimentalists hadn't thought about it this way. I've thrown up some papers. You can always see my website. I just want to show this last slide because I thought this was exciting. So what we did was we built these models that I showed you, and some reduced models, and we tested this hypothesis here. And we also showed the dynamical mechanism in the equations of why this would work. Okay, it sounds good, and we can show a simulation that shows that it works, but then, you know, I thought it was important that we could go one step farther and actually show this is why it works, okay? So then you have more of an understanding of what conditions are needed to make it work. And how can you maybe improve DBS by understanding how it works? But so now we've got this collaboration with Jerry Vitek and Cameron McIntyre, and so we actually have data from primate GPI, which was this output station of the basal ganglia, and we could feed it into our thalamic model. So these are some examples of traces. So these are, it's hard to see probably, but in red, we have these little blips. These are inputs to our thalamic model cells. In green, these traces are from the data. From, we took their spike times that they recorded from primates. This is a Parkinsonian primate. This is with deep brain stimulation, but at clinically ineffective parameter values. And this is with clinically effective deep brain stimulation. So we get these different GPI signals, which are our inhibition into the thalamus. And then you can see the thalamic cell spike pattern. So this is supposed to be voltage versus time. And here, the thalamic spiking is very poorly correlated to the red inputs that it was getting. And with this clinically effective DBS, it's doing this perfect job of relay. Just relaying its inputs one-to-one, which we're hypothesizing is sort of the rest state function of thalamus. Okay, big hypothesis there. And this is a more of a summary here. So we've got four cases here. We've got normal in purple. The Parkinsonian, the colors don't match. The Parkinsonian is blue. The sub-therapeutic DBS is green. And the therapeutically effective DBS is red. So these are all data from monkeys fed into our model. In each case, we computed an error index based on how well it was performing at relaying its input, and we computed a burstiness measure on the GPI input itself. And you can see, as you walk through these cases, the input actually gets more and more bursty, and it's important, I should say, for us, very high burstiness is actually just tonic, like on all the time, so a constant green trace up here. So this is more of an index of high-level GPI activity. So we get more and more GPI activity, just like I walked you through, but the error index gets worse in Parkinson's and then comes back and does very much like the normal case, so like normal relay is restored in clinical DBS. So I have one more point that I thought, I think mathematical training, a challenge coming from a mathematical training is when you want to prove a theorem, you sort of say, if I can set up these assumptions, then the theorem holds. Okay, so my tendency sometimes in models is if I set up parameters like this, as long as this is greater than this, and this is like this, you know, then I can get this really cool thing to come out of the model. But then, you know, reviewers will always ask, well, what about robustness to parameter variations? And probably, you know, I don't think about that as much because I think it's a result that you could sort of tune your parameters in a nice way using your understanding of the system and get out this really nice behavior. So that's an important thing that I've had to get used to. You always have to think about robustness, and this is very tied into Astrid's results that Ron mentioned. Okay, so finally, how does this work fit into a math department? It's a big challenge. Why would somebody working in, you know, in algebra or, you know, group theory, representation theory, and so on, you know, value this work? Will you get tenure credit? How do you get students to do their thesis work with you when their thesis will not, you know, get them a math PhD unless they've proved theorems and you're interested in having them, you know, take data from the GPI and feed it into a large-scale model of the thalamus? So these are some open questions as well. So thanks.